So last time, remember, I wrote down the formula for the classical channel capacity, which is just the mutual information between Alice's input and Bob's output the input to the channel and the output of the channel. So you can also get a quantum channel capacity. So remember, the situation is Alice is sending qubits to Bob, and there's some noise that's interfering. And so Alice wants Bob to receive her qubits with, you know, arbitrary high fidelity over n uses of the channel. And she wants to send the most possible information, quantum information, subject to this constraint. And so the standard formula for the quantum capacity is in terms of something called the coherent information. So the coherent information is going to depend on the channel and the state that you're sending through it. So one way to formulate it is to take a purification. So in this picture, yeah, maybe didn't leave enough space here, but instead of sending the state rho, you're imagining that rho is produced as the trace over R of some pure state psi. And R doesn't go through the channel. R gets held separately. And so then the coherent information is the entropy of E of rho. So that's the state that the entropy of the state that Bob receives, minus the entropy of E tensor I. Applied to psi. Okay, so it's the entropy of Bob's state minus the entropy of the global state after the channel. Okay, so this is right. So the intuition behind this is So the intuition behind this is basically that this is kind of the information that Bob learns that the channel does not. And one way to see that is we'd also write this as S of B. And this is S of BR. So one way of imagining this is to say that this noise is due to some environment E. And then since we started in a pure state, E interacts with the system, B, E, and R will have some global pure state. And therefore, based on the entropic properties that we had yesterday, the entropy of BR is equal to the entropy of E. Right? So this is the entropy of the environment after it interacts with the system. And so then this thing here would be equal to S of B minus S of E. See, so this is the like I said, the excess entropy that Bob has over what the environment has. And that, in some sense, represents the quantum information that's gotten through from Alice to Bob. That's not obvious, I should say, that's what that represents. But do you follow the definition and the logic, which are both a little bit subtle?
How do you know that this is purification independent?
Let's see. So, so suppose you apply some unitary here. And so that unitary is appearing on both sides here. Right? But this is the identity on the reference system. So so that's the same as doing I tensor U on this whole state here, right, before and after. Right, so the unitary on the reference system will commute with this kernel,
yeah.
Right? So it's I tensor U on this whole thing here, and the entropy is basis independent.
Yeah, but maybe the purification is in a larger Hilbert space, so.
Yeah, that doesn't matter, right? Because there's still going to be some unitary just within the larger Hilbert space, right? And so on one version of the purification, we'll only use some subspace of this bigger Hilbert space, and one will use the whole thing. And the entropy, again, doesn't depend on whether you use the subspace or the whole thing. It's got to be the same because they're unitary equivalent. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, and so then the theorem, sometimes called the LSD theorem, Lloyd, Shor, and Devitak, is that the quantum channel capacity is given by the following formula. The quantum channel capacity is the capacity to send qubits through the channel, otherwise analogous to the classical capacity. So if I just had something like this, I of rho comma e, supremum over rho, that would be total analogy to the classical thing, which, remember, was the maximum over x of the mutual information between x and y, where y is the output of the channel. Okay, I mean, it would be a different formula, of course, but it would look very similar. But it doesn't look like that. Instead, it has this 1 over n and e tensor n. And so rho here is a state on n on Alice's Hilbert space H tensor n. Which is a Hilbert space of n messages. Although this rho state is the thing that actually goes into the channel, of course, not the unencoded message. And so we do this over n copies of the channel. We take some state, do the channel n times, And then we divide by n. And we take the limit as n goes to infinity. And so why do we need to do that? Well, the problem is something called superadditivity. So it turns out that if you just calculate this coherent information on tensor product states, well, then I of rho tensor n, e tensor n, is just n times I of rho comma e. So there would be no value in doing this limiting procedure. But when you can send in entangled states to the channel, entangled over the n uses, then you can actually do better. And we know of cases of channels, including very simple channels, where you can do better. And so that means that as you use entangled states over more and more copies of the channel, this can get higher and higher, potentially. Okay, even though you're regularizing by dividing by n. So this is called the regularized coherent information. And the problem is that we don't really have any good bounds on how much better it can get. There are some upper bounds on the capacity, but by and large, we're not able to calculate the channel capacity for a wide variety of quantum channels. Now, there's some sets of channels for which this doesn't happen, and which you get what's called an additive coherent information. And then we do know the capacity, or at least we have. I mean, this is still a little bit difficult to calculate because it's a non-convex optimization, but it's in a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and so in principle you can do it. Whereas this one, we don't even know how to do it in principle because it involves a limit as n goes to infinity, and we don't know how fast it converges. In fact, we don't even know for sure that it's computable in the sense that I was talking about in the first beginning of the second week. Probably it is, but we don't really know that. So that's a big pain in the neck. So whereas we have this theorem which tells us what the quantum channel capacity is, for, like I said, for some very simple channels, we don't actually know what the capacity is in any meaningful sense. So one big goal of quantum Shannon theory would be to say, can we come up with what's called a single letter formula for the capacity, which would be something that doesn't have this limit as n goes to infinity, that only depends on quantities here of using a single use of the channel. Okay. Now, I should say that this phenomenon of superadditivity is very closely connected to the existence of degenerate quantum error correcting codes. Because those are cases where, I mean, so the way you prove Shannon's channel coding theorem is using a random code, and it turns out that a totally random code is not a good thing here. You want a somewhat non-random code that's taking advantage of degeneracy, taking advantage of the ability to kind of collapse different kinds of errors to do the same thing. Okay.
Why does the mutual information not work anymore?
Well, the mutual information was between classical things. There's a quantum version of the mutual information that uses the same formula, and it's So what was the mutual information? So let's take the quantum version of this formula. And you can immediately see that it's not going to give the right answer. Because what's the maximum value of the mutual information? Well, if the global state is a pure state, you have a maximally entangled state, then this is 0. And these are both 1. Right? So it can take a value 2. But we're not going to be able to send two qubits using one qubit. That's just not going to work. So this does have operational interpretations in the quantum case, but it's for more complicated scenarios. Let me think if I can remember exactly. This is probably a state merging thing. I don't remember offhand. Let's see, is there an intuitive notion as to why it's not right? The concept behind this mutual information is something which is not applicable in the quantum case, which is that you can talk about X and Y as existing simultaneously. In the quantum case, Alice has a state, she sends it to Bob, she doesn't have it anymore, right? In the classical case, Y is supposed to be the output of the channel, remember, and X is the input of the channel. But you know, in classically, Alice can keep a copy of whatever she sent in, and then Bob has his copy when he gets out, and so it does make sense to talk about kind of the correlations between them. In the quantum case, they're separated in time, but they can't exist at the same time. So that's another reason why this is not the right quantity to look at. It is a meaningful thing to look at in some circumstances, but only if you have two parties that share some state initially. And it's a question of what can you do with that. Other questions? Okay. So let me move on to measures of entanglement. So how do you quantify how much entanglement a system has? In fact, what does it mean for a pure for a non-pure state to be entangled? I'm going to focus on bipartite entanglement. So we have Alice and Bob, and they share some state. And so the distinction that we want to make is we want to say Alice and Bob are entangled if it's a kind of a non-classical state that they share, right? So we want to distinguish entanglement from correlation. Correlation is something that you can have classically, right? Whereas entanglement is supposed to be something that's special in quantum. And so this is usually done by saying Alice and Bob, they share some state, and they can communicate classically. And they can communicate back and forth, and they can do it in many rounds, as many times as they like. But if to start out with, they only share a tensor product state, and they only do this classical, they can do measurements on their sides, they can do whatever they want on their own side, and they can send classical information back and forth. But at the end of the day, they should not be able to make an entangled state that way. So this type of protocol where they can do local operations and classical communication is called LOCC. And so the theory of entanglement is built around this notion of LOCC. Okay, so based on that insight, what does it mean to be entangled? Well, we say that a state is separable if it can be written as a mixture of tensor product states. Okay. So why is that? Well, if you have such a state, you can make it via LOCC, right? Because Alice can generate the random number I, and then prepare the state rho A I, send I, which is a classical thing, to Bob, and then Bob can make the state rho B I, right? And now this is the state that they have. They then throw away the record of what I was. Okay? Those are all things that are allowed under LOCC. Conversely, if they do an LOCC protocol starting from a tensor product state, they will always have a separable state. Why is that? Well, if you look at every, you know, classical bit that was sent back and forth, you can write that down as one big number. Call it I, okay? And we had probability PI of getting different messages that were sent, different sequences of messages that were sent. And so that's these PIs. And based on this transcript I, you're going to have some tensor product state, because for a given message, for a given message sequence, you could have just said, well, okay, let's forget the message sequence, and we'll prepare the state that we got that way, right? Could have done that all the time. And so it has to be a tensor product state. Okay? So this is a state is separable if and only if it can be prepared via LOCC. Now, I could say that, well, first of all, you know, density, these kinds of decompositions of density matrices are not unique, right? And so there could be more than one decomposition of this form for a separable state. But there can also be given, you can be given a separable state, and there can be decompositions that are not of this form, right? So just because there exists a decomposition of this form doesn't mean that every decomposition has this form. And it generally will be the case that it won't, right? So an easy example of that, you look confused. An easy example, the maximally mixed state on two parties, right? So clearly, that's a separable state, right? Because it's a tensor product state of maximally mixed and maximally mixed. But you can also make it by a mixture of all the Bell pairs, right? There's four Bell states. They form bases. They're each of them maximally entangled. And a uniform mixture of them will be the maximally mixed state. OK? OK, so are there questions on separability? So this is the notion of an unentangled state. And then a state that is not separable is considered an entangled state. So that's the kind of the first step in quantifying entanglement, deciding what zero entanglement is and what non-zero entanglement is. But going beyond that to say how much entanglement in a state, that's a little more tricky. And so this is usually done in the context of some function which has to satisfy certain properties. And so those properties make it what's called an entanglement monotone. So the entanglement monotone will, for each quantum state, will assign some real number. I guess it's positive real numbers or non-negative. And it should have the following properties. So first of all, it could be zero for separable states. And it could be non-zero for at least some non-separable states. Okay, so I'm not going to insist that it be non-zero for all non-separable states. That's an additional property, although certainly an interesting one. And it could be unitarily invariant. But it only has to be unitarily invariant under local unitaries on Alice's and Bob's side. Right? Obviously, if you do some entangling operation between Alice and Bob, it can change. And then finally, it should not increase, this is the monotone part, on average, under LOCC. And I do kind of need the on average part because there are certain protocols that you can run that where you make some measurement, for instance, on Alice's side, and depending on the results of the measurement, maybe you're projecting onto a more entangled state. But the catch is that the other times the measurement outcome will correspond to a less entangled state. And therefore, you have this thing, this monotone is not increasing on average. Okay.
Why don't you want it to be zero, non-zero for all separable, non-separable states? Otherwise, you don't know if it's entangled.
Because it's right. Yeah. So So the background to this is that So there are many different ways of quantifying the amount of entanglement in a system. That's the bottom line. At least for mixed states. And so ideally, yes, you would like it to be non-zero for all non-separable states. So I could say that the, you know, when people started working on this in, say, the mid-90s, there was some hope that we could come up with the, you know, the perfect quantity that would quantify entanglement and would be very operational and, you know, satisfy all sorts of other properties. And after a while, it came clear that that was not likely to happen. Okay, and so people backed off and said, okay, we have lots of different notions of measuring the amount of entanglement. They're different, but what are the properties that we need in order for it to be a sensible notion? And this is a definite requirement. If it were equal to zero for all non-separable states, then it would just be uniformly zero, and that would be uninteresting. This one seems necessary as well, because otherwise it's a basis-dependent quantity, not really a property of the state precisely, but it's also of the basis that you're picking. This one is maybe you could give up if you really wanted to. This one though is important as well, right? This is capturing the notion that LOCC cannot. Not only cannot create entanglement, but cannot increase entanglement. And so once you back off and say, these are the things that I really need, then you're reluctant to add anything more. And one of the reasons for that is because there's notions that are otherwise very interesting. And I'll get to this in a little bit. There are some monotones that are very interesting and useful and that don't satisfy this, that are not faithful, that they don't have non-zero value for all entangled states. We'll get back to that in a few minutes.
So is the point that at least we know which states definitely have entanglement?
Yeah, so the idea is that if you have a state and you calculate its entanglement monotone and it's non-zero, then you definitely know it has entanglement. Let's get back to this after I've discussed some actual monotones. And then maybe it'll be clearer why those things would still be interesting. Okay. But are there other questions on this definition? Okay. So, so to start off, let's think about pure states, global pure states. So a global pure state, if it's a separable state, then it's just a tensor product state, right? Because we can only, for a pure state, we can only have one term in this sum. And so it has to be a tensor product state. And we also have a notion of what we think a maximally entangled state is, right? It could be, for qubits, it could be 0, 0, plus 1, 1. For d-dimensional qubits, it should be 0, 0, plus 1, 1, plus 2, 2, plus dot, 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 plus d minus 1, d minus 1. If you think about it, one notion that seems like a good candidate for measure of entanglement, and it is to take the global, not the global density matrix, but the local density matrix on Alice's side, and take some function of that. In particular, take the entropy. Okay, so why is this a good notion? Well, for one thing, it's equal to the density matrix on the entropy of the density matrix on Bob's side for a global pure state. Right. So choosing Alice versus Bob, that was not important. The other thing is that it doesn't depend on basis changes on Alice's side or Bob's side, right? Because if you apply U here, the entropy is unitarily invariant. And it's maybe a little less obvious, but it's true that it's not increasing on average under LOCC. So this is an entanglement monotone. For pure states. Let's see, was there anything else I wanted to say about it? Yeah, okay. So, and in fact, this is not just a reasonable notion of entanglement, but it also has some operational interpretations, right? It's the answer to some operational questions. So I think in the tutorial you did something on entanglement concentration, is that right? And so there, remember, the answer was this, right? The entropy of one side. So how many, if you have non-maximally entangled states and you convert them into maximally entangled states, how many can you get? Well, the answer is given by the entropy of the non-maximally entangled state. And that's totally consistent with saying that this is the amount of entanglement in the system. Right. So the thing is that for global pure states, you can come up with other entanglement monotones, but subject to a few other mild conditions, like it should be consistent on n copies. It turns out that the entropy is basically the only one. That other entanglement monotones that satisfy these additional properties will be functions of the entropy. Okay, so that's global pure states. Great, we have a good notion of entanglement. It's sensible. It's faithful. It's operational. It satisfies all the nice properties we would want. So for global pure states, at least we do have a nice answer. But for global mixed states, well, this immediately falls apart, right? If you have a tensor product mixed state, this is already non-zero. So it's definitely not a notion of entanglement. And moreover, it's not going to distinguish between classical correlation and quantum entanglement either, right? Even if you look at something like the mutual information, right? That's, you can have classical correlation there. So we're going to have to go to something different. So one approach is to come up with operational problems and define the entanglement monotones that are the answers to those problems. So for instance, you can say, how much entanglement is needed to make this state via LOCC? And so that gives you the entanglement of formation. So it's the, so if you look at different ensembles, such that sum of pi psi I is equal to rho. So these psi I's are entangled states in general. Then you look at the average amount of entropy on one side. That gives you the entanglement of formation. Right, and so this tells you. So remember, this amount here is this quantity. So it's the amount of entanglement entropy for the state psi I that appears in the decomposition. So this thing here gives you implicitly a protocol for making the state rho. Right, you say, well, with probability pi, I use the state psi I, which is an entangled state. It might be non-maximally entangled, but it kind of has this much entanglement, so it's kind of equivalent to that many EPR pairs. And then I'll take the average over pi to figure out how many EPR pairs I would need on average, basically, to make this state using this protocol. And then you're taking the minimum over all protocols. So if you had a separable state, this minimum is zero, right? Because you just use tensor product states here, and this is always zero. But if it's a non-separable state, then it's more. So let's go through the properties of the entanglement monotone, right? So I just said, if it's a separable state, it's zero. And it turns out, I believe that this is faithful, that if you have any non-separable state, yeah, right, it has to be right. Because if you have any non-separable state, then this decomposition has to have at least one entangled state in it, which will have non-zero entropy. And so this average will be positive. It's unitarily invariant, right? Because this entropy here is unitarily invariant. And it's non-increasing under LOCC. Why is that? Well, if you had a way to increase it under LOCC, then you would get a state that you go from the state rho to the state rho prime that has higher entanglement of formation. But that LOCC protocol, remember, basically gives you a decomposition into psi i's, right? You take the decomposition of rho, and then, you know, these i's become more complicated because now they're mixed up with all the classical messages that you send back and forth. But, you know, conditioned on each classical message, you say, what would be the pure state that I started with, right? And so that gives you a decomposition of rho prime. And that couldn't have used any more entropy than the state that you started with. Any more entanglement of formation in the state that you started with, because you were able to make that with LOCC in these states. Okay. LOCC is not adding any new entangled states. That's the whole point. Okay? So it can't be increasing under LOCC. Yes, that's right. Okay? Was that clear enough? Okay. So this seems like a pretty sensible notion. It's faithful. It is a monotone. It has an operational meaning. That's a pretty reasonable one. But unfortunately, it's not additive. So again, it has this problem of not being a single letter formula. So in particular, if you take two states, so if Alice and Bob are sharing two separate states, well, certainly they can make both of those states by making them separately, right? They must first make row AB and then forget about it for a moment and make row AB prime. And so this is the amount of entanglement needed to do that. But there are definite cases where they can do better by considering both states together. And they have protocols that will use less entanglement to create these two states in conjunction than to create them separately. Okay. And so this greatly complicates it. It means that entanglement information is not exactly just a property of the state. It's a property of the state and also what other states you have around that you're trying to make. Right. So that's makes it a little complicated. And in fact, it's even true when you take the same state tensor itself, that if you're trying to make two copies of the same state, that can be cheaper than making them separately, cheaper per copy. And so again, people will look at the regularized entanglement of formation called the entanglement cost. Where you say, okay, I want to make n copies of row AB, and what is the per copy entanglement of formation? And then I take the limit as n goes to infinity. Okay. And this maybe is a better representation of exactly what the real cost of making row AB is, although again, it can depend on the context, what other kind of states you want to create. But once again, this is something that's totally impossible to compute because it involves a limit as n goes to infinity, and we don't have any good bounds on how it behaves. Okay? So that's great. Well, not great, but you know, it gives us one way of quantifying entanglement, at least, in theory. But you might ask, so this is the amount of entanglement that you needed to put into the state to make it. At least in the pure state case, we can also go the other way, right? We can say we have this non-maximally entangled state, and we can get maximally entangled states out of it, right? So what if we try to do that for a mixed state? We have some mixed state, entangled mixed state, and we want to get maximally entangled states out of it. Well, that's a sensible question. It's, again, an operational quantity. And Maybe I won't start. No, okay, I guess I will. Sorry. Indecisive. So if you do that, you say, okay, I'm gonna start with a mixed entangled state row AB, and I'm gonna run an LOCC protocol, and the goal is to output as many maximally entangled states as I can. Right. So if I'm maximized over all procedures I can run, that gives me what's called the distillable entanglement. OK. Okay. So it's maybe worth making a distinction between one-way distillation procedures, where the classical communication is only from Alice to Bob, and two-way distillation procedures, where they can talk back and forth, like in the general LOCC case. And the one-way case is basically, these distillation procedures are basically the same as quantum error correcting codes. Okay, I mean, they're not 100% equivalent, but you know, up to teleportation, basically. You say, if I have this mixed state and I teleport through it, that's like a noisy quantum channel, and I could run an error correcting code, start with a maximally entangled state, encode half of it in error correcting code, teleport it through the channel. That's a one-way distillation procedure. And it's kind of equivalent to the arbitrary one-way distillation procedures. Whereas the two-way communication lets you do more. And I think I mentioned this Wednesday when we talked about QKD, right? In the specific context of loss. So again, you're taking some maximum over protocol, and again, unfortunately, not additive. In this case, it's super additive rather than sub additive. So that means that given multiple copies of a state, you might be able to get more maximally entangled states out per copy than you would from a single copy. Okay. So again, if you want to do this, you should look at the regularized version, where you take the limit as n goes to infinity, 1 over n times the protocol on n copies of the state, the best protocol on n copies of the state. So the interesting thing from this perspective about the distillable entanglement is that it's less, well, certainly it's less than or equal to the entanglement of formation, right? Because otherwise you could use some protocol to create this state and then distill out more entanglement than you started with. So distillable entanglement has to be less than or equal to the entanglement of formation. But we know cases where it's not equal. In fact, it's generally not going to be equal. And moreover, we know cases where the entanglement of formation is positive, but the distillable entanglement is not. And so this is an example of why we don't necessarily want to insist that it be faithful, right? Because this distillable entanglement otherwise is a very sensible notion of entanglement, right? Again, it's hard to compute, but it's an entanglement monotone, and it's answering a very important operational question. Given this mixed state, how much entanglement can we get out of it? But there's some states called bound entangled states, where it takes entanglement to make them, but you can't get entanglement out. Now again, because of you know, super additivity issues, sometimes given a bound entangled state and some other entangled state, you can get out more entanglement than you could have just out of the second state itself. Right? So that's called activating the bound entanglement. So you can get all sorts of stuff like that. But it means that the structure of these entangled states is going to be very complicated. Okay. So one more measure of entanglement, and then I'll stop. So the main issue with these two measures that I've just given you is that they're very nice and operational, but they're very hard to compute. Okay, even in the single shot case, they're not that easy to compute because they involve maximizations over stuff, protocols or decompositions. So it's nice to go to something that's much more simple. And so this is. So So this is given in terms of something called the partial transpose. So so rho is a bipartite state, rho AB, right? And you can write it as a matrix, you know, over the A tensor B Hilbert space. But suppose we write it as blocks, right? So there's the A blocks and the B blocks. And what we're going to do is we're going to treat each A block as its own matrix, right? Varying over the different values of the A basis, for instance, and take the transpose just of the A block. Okay. Now, this is not a completely sensible quantum operation. Partial transpose is a positive map on density matrices. Because transpose is positive because if you map a density matrix, if you take the transpose of the whole density matrix, you're definitely getting another valid quantum state. But it's not completely positive. And so in particular, if you apply the partial transpose to a separable state in general, to a non-separable state, to an entangled state, let's say a maximally entangled state, just for the easy case, you'll get something that's not a density matrix because it has negative eigenvalues. And so the negativity is then the sum of the negative eigenvalues under partial transpose. Okay? And so again, if you take a maximally entangled state, you take the partial transpose, you'll get some negative eigenvalues. So this is something that's non-zero for some entangled states. Let's see. So it's unitarily invariant, right? The eigenvalues are not going to change on a unitary. And this partial and transpose is kind of, I mean, it may, yeah. So the transpose is actually, the partial transpose is a basis dependent thing, in the sense that if you take rho transpose in one basis versus another basis, you'll get different things. They won't be unitarily equivalent, but they will have the same eigenvalues. And in particular, the negativity will be the same. And you can also show that it's non-increasing under LOCC. And another nice thing about the negativity is that it's actually additive. So if you have rho tensor sigma, then the negativity of that is equal to the negativity of rho plus the negativity of the sigma. But what it's not is faithful. So again, there are states that have zero negativity, so they're positive under partial transpose, PPT, but they are entangled states. And such a state has to be a bound entangled state, right? Because if you could, if you could distill entanglement from such a state, then there would be an LOCC protocol that would take this state, which has zero negativity, and convert it into maximally entangled states, which have positive negativity. Some of the absolute value of the eigenvalues, right? And we know that can't happen because negativity is a monotone. So this is in fact how we know for sure that there's bound entanglement. It's possible that there exists some bound entangled states that do not have positive partial transpose. But this is still an open question, actually. It's been open for 20 years or something to prove that. OK, So I guess that's it for the class. Are there questions on this?
In general, you could have a state that has not has what's the opposite of bound entanglement?
I guess unbound entanglement.
Unbound, yeah.
Free entanglement. I'm not sure it has a name. That's in wide currency.
Yeah. You could have a state that has I guess distillable entanglement.
Yeah.
And then that state will have some negativity, but if you then use local operations to, I guess you can't increase entanglement.
Well, I mean, the negativity could decrease under your protocol.
Yeah.
So the negativity doesn't tell you what the distillable entanglement is. Right? It could be less than you might, the distillable entanglement might be less than what you would get from the negativity.
You're saying you could increase the distillable entanglement and decrease the negativity?
No, the distillable entanglement is a monotone. It's defined as the most amount of entanglement you can get via an LSCC protocol. So you definitely can't increase it, because if there was some protocol to increase it, then you would do that always.
Yeah.
And then, but what I'm saying is that the negativity is non-increasing under LSCC, but it can decrease under LSCC. So the protocol that distills entanglement, the best protocol that distills entanglement, might be a protocol that decreases the negativity. Okay, so the negativity of the states that you get at the end could be less than the negativity of the states that you started with.
Okay. Sorry, so if you start out with zero negativity, you say that you had a bound entangled state because otherwise you could use local operations to increase the negativity?
Right, that's right. That's right. Yes. That was the argument.
But the point is that you could do that because you could turn bound entangled.
If you have a state that's not bound entangled, you can create maximum entangled states out of it. And so if you had a non-bound entangled state with zero negativity, that would be a contradiction.
So the maximally entangled state doesn't have more entanglement than the
No.
That you condensed it.
No. So the distillable entanglement of a maximally entangled state is, well, if it's one EPR pair, then it's one.
Yeah.
Because the protocol is don't do anything. Yeah. So the bottom line of this discussion, and maybe what we're getting to, is that the negativity has to be greater than or equal to the distillable entanglement. And moreover, it has to be less than or equal to the entanglement of formation by kind of the dual argument, right? And in fact, that's true of pretty much every sensible measure of entanglement, that it's going to sit in between the entanglement of distillation and the entanglement of formation. And this is up to these asymptotic issues, right? So if you take the regularized versions of these, that's only going to be true in the regularized case. Okay, does that help to clear up what you're talking about?
I cleared up what I wanted to understand.
Any other questions? Okay. Then thanks to those of you who stuck it out to the end.
Thank Daniel for a really-